It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. If you can't get enough of The Real Housewives, RuPaul's Drag Race, Lady Gaga, Taylor Swift, or if you're someone who just wants to sound like you know all about these cultural touchstones and more, then chances are you're familiar with...
Ding dong! Lost Culturistas calling!
Comedians Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang have been hosting the podcast Lost Culturistas since 2016. On the show, they pick apart all the pieces of culture they love, and as you can probably tell, they don't take themselves too seriously while doing it.
Bo, it's our 301st episode, a new era.
Can you believe? I didn't think we would make it to 5.
Well, Mama, as Shania Twain once said, looks like we made it. Look how far we've come, my baby.
You might also know Yang from Saturday Night Live. In this spring, Matt Rogers is poised to have his own breakout moments in front of the camera. He's co-starring with Yang in Hulu's upcoming film, Fire Island. And Rogers can also be seen in the new Showtime series, I Love That For You. The series stars Vanessa Bayer as a woman who lies about having cancer in order to keep her job at a QVC-like network. Rogers co-stars as Darcy, the senior associate to the head of the network, played by Jennifer Lewis.
And Joanna, please don't dress like that.
Oh, like what?
Like a little twee hayseed.
Basically, we don't want you to wear anything with like French writing on it or like an avocado with a face or a hedgehog with like a top hat or like that.
Matt Rogers, thank you for joining us here on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me. Melissa Harris-Perry, unreal. This is very cool.
Oh, man. I feel like, wait a minute. I totally need like a TikTok channel called Melissa Harris-Perry Unreal. Like that's, I'm sorry. You just, when I steal that later, don't be mad.
Honestly, it's yours. Please. This is huge for me to be talking to you. I'm happy to, you know, help with any TikTok explosion you may have from here on out.
All right. I want to talk about Darcy. That's your character in I Love That For You. Would you assess him as being a little, I don't know, harsh?
You know what? Here's the thing about Darcy. Darcy works in a toxic work environment. And what happens to you when that's true is you yourself, I think, adopt a lot of the characteristics that you see working in your superiors. So he works for Patricia Cochran, who's played by Jennifer Lewis, extremely huge icon to me in my life. I still have to wrap my head around the fact that I'm around her all the time. But, you know, she runs things a certain way and she plays her employees like pawns. And honestly, I think that she believes it creates better work on air at the Special Value Network. And I think when you're surrounded by so much toxicity, it sort of just becomes a part of what you do. So I don't think he has a bad heart. I just think he is code switching and trying to be who he thinks is going to be an effective person in this particular work environment. And I mean, you see what happens when someone who makes their entire life their job, when that person starts to feel devalued and like they can't even stand by their own behavior. So it's actually really interesting to play this kind of person who walks around like they're the Emily Blunt in Devil Wears Prada, but, you know, really wants to be that effortless and flawless and cruel, but is not actually.
I feel like we must be like mind melding here, because the very next thing I was going to say was, yeah, but in Devil Wears Prada and in some of the like, I don't know, I guess it's like the X-gen to millennial version of the world, right? The whole idea was that you would only like that one likable character, right, that would show up out of a toxic work environment, right? So it would be as though the hero or shero was always the one who could sort of rise above. And I'm wondering if it's a sort of, you know, a part of the insight of the moment in which we now live that provides us the possibility of seeing the ways that toxicity creates toxicity.
Yeah, I think that's actually something that's really smart in the show. And Vanessa Bayer and Jeremy Byler and Jesse Klein, our showrunner, they've created actually a protagonist in Joanna who, you know, the whole crux of the show is that morally she does something that on paper, if you read about it, you know, in the news today, you'd be like, okay, put this woman in jail. She lied about having cancer to keep her job. And that is something, like I said, on paper, you'd be like, no way. But you understand her motivations and where she's coming from, and you don't co-sign with what she does, but you have a deeper understanding of why she may have felt pushed to that place. And I think that's a theme that runs through all of the characters. You know, when you first meet them, of course, they feel stuck. You have the, you know, the antagonist, other on-camera talent who, you know, is very self-possessed. And you have, you know, what I would refer to as the stereotype that I'm playing, which is sort of the gay assistant, you know? And then I think as the series goes on, you see just how everyone is actually presenting one thing to the world. And when the doors are closed behind them, they are something else. So I think in a series, you know, you can really explore what makes a character dynamic. Whereas in a film like Devil Wears Prada, you know, we're really on the side of Anne Hathaway because we have 2 hours with her. This is a series where we have 8 episodes and knocking wood, hopefully more, to explore the psyche of someone like Joanna, who's our protagonist, and also everyone else. So, because the fact is people are not cut and dry, you know, and what I really like about the show is that exploration of, you know, when the stakes are really high and someone takes themselves really seriously, what happens when their value is called into question and they've needed to be challenged on whether or not this person they've presented to the world is working and is someone that they can stand by being.
That experience of being at your core, someone who identifies with your work, perhaps more than any other thing that leads with that in your identity, and then suddenly finding it challenged or stripped away. I think so many people experience that with the quarantine of the pandemic. Even if you were still working your job, you were working in such a different environment. And I think it feels to me like a lot of us had to ask that question. Wait. Who am I if I am not this thing that I do all day at work?
Right. And it also, it changed, I think, you know, I'm a very sort of goal-oriented, success-oriented person. And when the pandemic happened, you know, I didn't want to be sitting there actually looking at myself and peeling back the layers emotionally, but here we are. And yes, I am in therapy as of the pandemic. So, I mean, like the good things did happen. And I, you know, in terms of emotional growth, because I think we were all asked to actually stop for a second and look at who we were. But the fact is, you know, and I love that for you, we are telling a story about, you know, a work environment where we're all told it's the most important thing in the world. And all of a sudden those things are called into question. So it's a really interesting, you know, examination, especially when you take into account it's the world of home shopping. And it's so funny you bring up the pandemic, because that's also some retail therapy was huge for me during the pandemic.
Listen.
Yeah. Oh, please. And the thing about retail therapy is it works. And that's why, or at least it works for a moment, which I think speaks to our show. And, you know, this sort of metaphor of shopping to fill a hole. You know what I mean? It's like when we have something coming in the mail, we're looking forward to something and we are going to get that serotonin burst when we get it. But I think all the characters in our show actually have deep emotional holes that they need filling. And so this environment of the home shopping network where it's constantly being told, you know what you need? This. It's going to make you feel better in X and Y ways. You know, it's that sort of transient, that chasing of the thing that's going to make me feel better. And that thing that's going to, when I step out into the world, make everyone say, oh, I understand better who that person is because I see them in this or doing this. It's a really interesting show about self-perception when it's all taken into account. I'm really happy to be a part of it as like a, you know, clown from basement to New York City who was doing screaming sketch comedy for years. It's like, oh, cool. I get to be a part of this smart comedic piece. That'll work for me.
And well, first of all, I love that for you. And but also,
what
not,
is that?
There's that. But also not just that, but you're doing some other things. You are also co-starring in the upcoming Fire Island. Now, you've totally sold me on why the iteration of a series gives us potentially more than a film. But talk to me about this film and what it represents for you and for your friends. Y'all are like all doing this together.
Yeah, it's really wild. So Fire Island is an adaptation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, and it's set in the Fire Island Pines over a week in the summer where a group of best friends who are this sort of stand-in for the Bennet family all experience a week together on Fire Island. And if anyone out there has ever been to the Fire Island Pines, you know that it's a week or however long you spend there that seems to, you know, in terms of how time works, it doesn't exactly apply. It seems like time sort of goes away. It's almost like you get sucked into this vacation vortex when you're in Fire Island. And it's really an interesting mapping, the Pride and Prejudice onto the Fire Island Pines experience, because there is so much going on there with, you know, wanting to be desired, wanting to be wanted, you know, the concept of a sisterhood, competition amongst a family, you know, in this case, a group of friends. And my friend Joel Kim Booster, who stars in the film, also wrote the movie and adapted Pride and Prejudice to this environment. And he's such a thoughtful, intuitive, funny person. And so therefore, so is his script. And it was directed by the amazing Andrew Ahn, who is just he's got such an incredible eye for detail and such a sympathetic director that I think what we have here is an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice that is really fun and is going to make for a very fun movie for queer audiences now in the year of our Lord 2022. But also I can say it's a fantastic adaptation of a classic, and I'm describing it as equal parts slutty and soulful. So I think that'll attract a wide audience. If not, whatever, I tried my best.
Yes. Particularly at that intersection. Yes. Okay. I'm for that.
It can be achieved. And there's something that happens too when you go on vacation and you turn off certain filters in your brain. You know, you really see what happens when characters are like, all right, this is my week to go for it, and I'm going to let my inhibitions drop. And it's just a really funny, smart, and sweet movie that I get to do with Joel Kim Booster and my true dear, you know, other half of my heart, Bowen Yang, who is my best friend, has been for over 10 years. And I'm so proud of their performances. And the entire ensemble is just, I think it's going to be a cool one.
Talk to me about the queer rom-com. And it's still so unexplored, or at least underexplored. But I'm wondering if you have any favorites in this still sort of relatively nascent genre.
You know what's funny? I think that romantic comedies actually, they do something different to queer people, I think, of my generation and up, because whenever we were watching romantic comedies growing up, like I remember watching, all my favorites are Julia Roberts and Sandra Bullock and, you know, the ones of the 90s. Like I loved My Best Friend's Wedding, and I liked The Proposal with Sandra Bullock. And the thing about it is you're never watching yourself do it when you're a queer person. So it's always this, it's like, you know, I would consider myself a romantic when I'm watching them, because I'm so enjoying watching the romance come together and fall into place. But the thing is, when you're a queer person and you're coming up in a media landscape where it's not mirrored back to you ever seeing yourself have that big kiss at the end of the movie, or ever seeing yourself, you know, get told that you're an object of desire in that way that, you know, it feels like, you know, who's so good at receiving adoration is Sandra Bullock, the way her eyes just water up and, you know, she gets told and she finally realizes that she is worthy of love. It's like, you know, we're sitting there and it's like, you know, not even in a movie does this happen for us. Like Sandra Bullock can barely believe it in this movie. Like I'm in it for me at all. So in this recent moment where, you know, we have Fire Island and we have Bros coming out, Billy Eichner's Bros coming out later in the year. And, you know, we had the television series, you know, Looking, and you see in certain films and television series as of late, like at least maybe the B story or secondary story will be a queer subplot where you get to see a queer person win. I think it's really cool, but I can't say that I have a favorite in the genre yet, because I don't want to pick out of two or three. I'm going to wait till we have a Julia Roberts, you know, sized oeuvre, and then I'm going to get back on the takeaway and say my favorite one. But for right now, I'm going to say I feel really hopeful that we're going to be mirroring back to a new generation a sense of romance that we can look forward to, hopefully.
Fair point. You don't have to pick among two or three. We'll wait till we've got a bigger choice set.
Well, I pick Fire Island.
Okay. There you go. That's a good one.
Yeah. Trust me, it is. I was crying when I finished watching it because, you know, I won't spoil anything, but obviously Pride and Prejudice ends a certain way. So fans of the novel will understand what they can look forward to. But just seeing that image that I had never seen before and, you know, just the love and care with which Andrew Ahn shot a moment of romance between two men, specifically of two queer Asian men, is something that moved me. And I think I know for a fact is going to change things for kids watching it, because I think that was the most difficult thing of being a young, closeted, confused person is, for me, it was not mirrored. There was not a happy life modeled back to me by any role models or any actors or actresses in films that I was watching. And so just that is so meaningful. And I think that's what moves me so much about it. It could just be some music cue and I'm just basic, but you know.
Well, I was going to say, when you were like, oh, not that you want to spoil anything, I was like, well, if you can spoil the end of Pride and Prejudice, y'all have done something entirely different, but okay, I got you. I got you on the...
Yeah. So. Well, at least they know I read books. You know what I mean? It's important on MHB. If I come on your show, it's like, they should know I read books. Or at least I'll do a good job pretending. I refuse to look dumb in front of you.
All right. So on that point, though, let's talk about high and low culture. Because as you talk about the incredible podcast that you do with your longtime dear friend, Bowen Yang, talk to me about high and low culture. And, you know, why do we love The Real Housewives of Atlanta so very much, even though we know better?
You know what? We love The Real Housewives of Atlanta so much just because they're funny, okay? Yeah. And everyone understands what it means, like, to live a human experience and have the serotonin bump of just seeing, like, a group of friends, you know, tear each other up, you know, with love and sometimes with not so much love. But, and I think that's something in Fire Island, too, that people are really going to like, is seeing a sense of community and watching a group of friends have actual chemistry on screen. But to answer your question about high-low culture, I genuinely think, and this was funny, during the pandemic, you know what I got really into again? Survivor. And I was sitting here, and it was the early days of the pandemic, and I was like, why am I so obsessed with watching this right now? And I think in quarantine, it was like, well, I know that I'm watching Survivor, and I know these people are in a worse situation than I am, and I'm seeing them prevail. You know what I mean? So I think for me, it's like, when I watch reality TV or I watch Housewives or I watch, you know, whatever experience is being depicted on screen, it's just, I just want to go for a ride with whatever it is that's happening. I want to like escape, like, you know, the malaise or the, you know, stagnancy of my situation and go on a ride. And when it comes to high and low culture, I think we're only told what's high and low culture. You know what I mean? We're only told that the opera is high culture and that the Kardashians are low culture, you know? And I think that those things, for better or worse, sort of are melting away a little bit now that people can really decide for themselves what culture they're going to allow themselves to seep in. You know, we are years gone from the monoculture where it was, you know, there was one movie everyone was watching and it was Titanic. And there was one, you know, singer everyone loved and it was Madonna. You know, it's we are so far away from being expressly expected to stan, if you will, one particular thing in the culture. And I think now that people are finding their own pathways and their own cultural, you know, touchstones, it's interesting to see what's happening. And on Las Culturistas, I just think it's funny to talk about, you know, Taylor Swift and I don't know, like, let's just, we would never talk about this, but Mozart in the same breath. You know what I mean? It's just, there's a sense of irony and comedy to it in taking the non-serious very serious. But also I think it's an actual thing about the way that we all live is we need to be challenged, yes, by culture, but also sometimes we need to have fun.
You know, I wonder, as you go back to the point around queer representation in rom-coms, about what can sometimes feel like this pressure for communities and groups and voices and experiences that are underrepresented, that somehow whatever cultural products we're going to be represented in have to be kind of high culture. So I think, you know, it's kind of like the Harlem Renaissance argument, right? That, we have to demonstrate our capacity, you know, as Black folks for philosophy and great literature. And at that time, right, this idea that basically Zora Neale Hurston was writing rom-com and therefore it was, you know, it was a trash novel that we shouldn't pay attention to. But there's actually some value. Like, I think of the excitement, the enthusiasm, just the mirroring back, as you were talking about, that happens in seeing yourself, even in something like, you know, an HGTV, you know, somebody who's getting
exactly,
you know, yeah, like your house renovated. It's like, oh, but that's, you know, why was it only like cis, straight, white, rich couples that were getting their house renovated? What about us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what people don't understand is when you don't see it, you don't believe that it can exist, period. And I think that, you know, the thing is, like, you mentioned like an HGTV host, but if there is no Black HGTV host or there is no gay HGTV host and you are, you know, you were born into a society where you don't see that person in not just that role, but so many roles, you psychologically start to really think, oh, those things must not be for me, you know? And so that is, I think, when it comes to representation in media, that is also, I think, why we are so hard on the media that represents us. And it can be frustrating as a creator who just wants to, who wants people to understand how difficult it is to get anything made from a underrepresented perspective, but also deeply understands the high bar that everyone has, because I think we're all anxious that someone's going to mess up and then no one's going to get a chance again. And that is a burden that I think, I mean, you obviously understand. And I think anyone from any, you know, non-white, straight male perspective can have some understanding of, which is, you know, that thing of, I don't want to let people down. And also, I want them to know I'm trying my best and that I have the best intentions. So, you know, I'm definitely aware of it whenever I am in a project that is all queer people. And luckily, and I'm very proud to say, that is most of the stuff that I've done. But it does come with an expectation, and it comes with extra eyes, and it also comes with more perception. And that is difficult. So the good news is, I get to do it surrounded by people that I genuinely love and trust. And another, you know, element of this is when there is more, there's less competition. I think that we're all, the people of my generation and my peers are all super supportive of each other, which I've seen more and more of. It feels like there's more lifting each other up, at least in the artistic community, when it comes to someone having a new project out. Twitter's always going to be Twitter. You know what I mean? Like, it's like anyone that can get online and say anything nasty, they're going to do that as long as they have a computer or a phone or whatever it is. But it feels different on the inside of it. And that is encouraging. So that's where it's positive.
I feel like there's only one way to wrap this conversation, and that's by asking you, is there a recent piece of culture that made you say culture is still for me?
Oh my gosh, that is so funny. You know, I recently, and you know, who knows how much longer we're going to be able to do this. And so while we are able to go do it, I've been doing it, but I've been going to concerts again. I recently went to go see Haim, the band Haim, play at the Hollywood Bowl. And I just had such an amazing time watching live music. And I was recently talking with a group of friends about what our first concerts were, and I'm very proud to say that mine was Mariah Carey. And so
new addition right here, new addition. So I feel
there we go. Yeah, for me it was the Mariah Carey Rainbow Tour. I remember it was iconic because she had her Heartbreaker video where she played two characters, Mariah and Bianca.
Yes, and they fought each other.
Yes, they did, in the movie theater bathroom. And I remember at the concert, the whole bit was that Bianca was afoot. And so, you know, a quote-unquote Mariah would come out in a Bianca wig, and the whole Madison Square Garden would be screaming, Bianca, there she is, get her, Mariah. And I was just, you know, in seeing Haim the other day, like just watching live music, and I just went back through all the concerts I've I've seen. And I was like, wow, live music is something that I love so much and such a part of what I enjoy. So I bought a bunch of tickets for the rest of the year. I'm going to go see the Chicks. I'm going to go see Ben Platt. I'm going to go see Maren Morris. I'm going to go see, you know, and I guess I'm just waiting any day now for Beyonce to say anything about what she's got going on, because I've seen her three times and it's been a transformative experience every time. So I'm looking forward to another one. It feels like it's time.
Listen, it is a date, Matt. If you want, if B comes to the Garden, we got to go. Like,
there we go. I will come in from LA where I am now. I mean, for MHP, please. MHP and B and me. Come on.
Oh my God. It would be all the things.
Truly.
Matt Rogers is a comedian and actor currently starring in I Love That For You and the upcoming Fire Island, and catch him at the live music venue near you.
Yes, I'll be there. I'll be there watching whoever it is.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.